I think that it is important that we sort of look back at our history a little bit and where we go in terms of the future and what role we might play in that. Session, but he felt ill and was unable to do it. So Richard Smiley and myself will sort of direct us, if you will. So we'll start with the person to my right. As they say something and people want to jump in, just jump in and identify yourself, okay?
Do we want to have a first round just identifying?
Yeah. I think that would be good.
Yeah.
And then after that, we all jump in?
Yeah.
Okay.
Does that make sense to everybody?
Makes sense.
Okay. Sounds good.
Yeah, I'm not sure where we're going first, but I'm Carlton Olson. I was in Birmingham working out of Miles College's citizenship project, and they had an ongoing voter right campaign for 3 or 4 years before 65, so I was part of that. And I think I'll wait till the next round.
Okay. Charlie Buell, Surry County, Virginia. Surry County also had a strong tradition there, which I would mention.
Just leave it in. Okay. Just leave it in the sun. Yeah, we'll pick up. Oh, we got two? How did we wind up with two?
Go ahead.
I'm Barb Foster. I'm from Indiana. And I worked in Albany, Georgia with a group of 6 students, I think it was, in 2 months. That was our kind of our identifying.
I'm Kathy Schwartz, and I live in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and I was in Lunenburg County, Virginia.
I'm Al Kumpan. I live in Toledo, Ohio now, and I was also in Lunenburg County, Virginia.
I'm Margaret Roska. I am from Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and I work in Bullock County, Alabama.
I'm Rondia Coffer. I was not in a scope project, but I was living in Chicago, and I now live in California.
I'm Tom Rothschild. I was working in Newberry County, South Carolina.
My name is Richard Smiley. I worked in Selma, Alabama. I worked in Birmingham, and did some work in Mississippi and Dawson, Georgia. And I live in Tampa, Florida now.
My name is John Reynolds. With the Scope Project, I've worked in Pike County and Dale and Geneva County. And I worked with FCLC all over the place. I settled in Rhode Island because did the recruiting for New England for the Poor People's Campaign, and I met my wife and decided to stay. Excuse me.
We'll sign in. Can I have a pen back when you finish signing in?
Do I remember correctly? Is John a pastor? Is he a minister?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. Part of his education was in divinity. I think he had a M something in divinity.
There was a high concentration of pastors and ministers in SCLC.
Right.
It was at the time.
Right.
For some strange reason.
Some of them was ministers and some of them was called ministers. See, everybody that spoke in SCLC, they called a reverend. So I became a reverend.
Because
I don't think Jesse Jackson was a reverend until he started working with Operation Birdbath.
Tom Rothschild, one of the things that was pointed out in our South Carolina group by a couple of the other people, I think they were working on the island St. John's, but anyway, Ann Island, was that they deliberately called people reverend because they would mostly be speaking in the churches,
right,
and that would give them more status, whether they were or not. So when you got up to speak, you were introduced as Reverend so-or-so without any inquiry as to whether there was any reality behind that.
Right. And it was one of those things that people accepted.
And people accepted.
Right. So here we are. You know, we are talking about our scope have changed the political landscape in the South. And I just say, you know, one of the things we look back before 1965, that you only had, 400 or 500 black elected officials all over the country. And now you look, today we got thousands and thousands of black elected officials. And think out of those 600 were very few in the South, the counties and states that you work in. So we can start there and we see where we at now. We have, one of the things about this, that we have a mark on history. No one can take that away from us, you know. We put our lives on the line to change history. And so we look at the voting bill, you know, what effect the voting bill had on voting and registering and impact, you know, that whole landscape of the political framework. I think Dr. King said in one of his speeches that, you know, we had everything. They had the Civil Rights Bill. They had everything else, but they still couldn't participate in the decisions that were made about our lives in that time. So that's my little start off, warm up.
I was particularly Charlie Buell. Charlie Buell, Surrey County. I was particularly impressed by the comments I believe you made, John, that we're going through the end of a second Reconstruction, and with the issues therein that that are being raised is not the right to vote so much, although that is there, but circumscribing the number of people who can vote by supposedly legal means, and unfortunately there aren't the evil people whom you can you can focus on, and the strictly evil the things they had, and voter registrator people slamming the doors and so forth. It's a lot more sophisticated, and I'm just wondering to try to reverse the fall of the second Reconstruction. What are the tactics here?
Rhonda Coffey here. What I see now, as opposed to what went on then, our children are hearing what we went through different medias that are gearing their speeches and their ways towards our children, like the Daily Show and the Nightly Show, especially the Nightly Show. Those are being tools to connect our children what went on with us back in the 60s. And from what I see, they're really starting to understand what we went through during those days, and they are asking a lot of questions. When I heard that the voting law was being dismissed, our children was up in arms on MTV. They're saying, vote. MTV. So I think that it is the second Reconstruction. It came along slowly, but I think it's up and going.
That's good.
Kathy Schwartz. I have a son who's 41 now, and in my moments of despair, I would say to him, oh my God, it's like, what good did we do? And he would say, Mom, you really did. He was, you know, it's like he had heard the stories for a long time. So he would be very supportive, and he says, you know, now it's a new thing, but you need to be proud of what you did. And in terms of where of the future, I have had very little to do with the Black Lives Matter movement, except to say I don't think you should be blocking the highways, and for which I got a lot of flack. But I looked online for SCLC's relationship. I find something about SCLC's relationship with the Black Lives Matter movement. So this was the one article that I found, which I brought copies of. It's fairly long, and it kind of goes into
for everybody.
Yeah, the differences between, like, SCLC was not all the same thing. That Julian Bond wasn't the same person, kind of person as Andy Young, etc. And so that there's lots of rooms and trying to make comparisons between the time then and the differences in tactics, and the times now and the differences in tactics. I'm not here to speak for Black Lives Movement. I just thought that was so in our face.
Let me just come in, and you know, I was telling someone in my group this morning that, you know, the Black Lives Matter, I think they sort of missed that on the history. That if we look at that, you had 500-600 white students that came to the South in 1965 to do voter registration, that, you know, your life mattered just as much as my life, because during that time, if something happened to you, it happened to all of us. So I don't jump out on that bandwagon, Black Lives Matter. I think that, all lives matter. And that's why, you know, when I talk to my young people in class, I let them know that there were some white people involved that gave their life for what we have today. So, you know, we can't, you know, just, and I think, what's his name was talking about that today when he went to Ferguson. Mm-hmm. And Ferguson said, we don't want to hear you old people. And they start cursing and all that stuff. Now, that's the, you know, that young people that sort of don't know their history. And you know, I have to think about, you know, that, because the impact that Scope had and doing that air had on me, I think that all life matter. And I, you know, wherever I, you know, my class and everything, place else, I say that. So,
go ahead.
Okay.
Repeat your name, please.
Oh, my name is Margaret Rosga. I worked in Bullock County, Alabama. Since then, I've continued to be involved in civil rights movements and issues, mostly in Milwaukee. As far as the impact of what we did in Alabama, one of the local volunteers sent us a news clipping after where in the spring of 1966 three African Americans came in first for the offices that they were running for, tax assessor, Alabama state representative, and sheriff. Now, they didn't win the general election, but the next year they won elections. So there was an immediate impact in my county in terms of African Americans getting political office. In terms of looking forward, looking to date, I've been working with a nonprofit in Milwaukee, Arts Across the Curriculum, and we did two civil rights projects. And in both cases, the students began not knowing very much about the civil rights movement, either nationally or locally or Southern civil rights movement, except they knew the names Martin Luther King and Rosa Parks, and that was kind of the civil rights movement to them. These are mostly African American students. What they found in doing the research and then creating a museum exhibit to represent what they were learning was powerfully motivating to them. So much so that they came during their spring break to work on doing the exhibit. When the project was over, they didn't want to let go. They sponsored a youth leadership summit in the city of Milwaukee, had 100 students come from various schools, and they could have had more, but they didn't have room for them. But there were more students who wanted to be involved. So the stories that we have to tell, I have seen, have been terrifically empowering for young people. And they're empowering partially because they hear stories of teenagers who were involved. Mm-hmm. Because if the civil rights movement is Martin Luther King and Rosa Parks, that doesn't say very much to an African-American living in an African-American neighborhood in Milwaukee about what they can do. But if they hear that 15 and 16-year-olds and 12-year-olds were involved in Selma and in Milwaukee and elsewhere, then that says a lot to them about, if they did it, maybe I can do it. And so I've just been really terrifically encouraged by the results of those projects and the young people that have gone through them and have gone on to work on their own issues. They work on the things that matter to them, and they work on them with the tactics that they devise. But they feel empowered. They feel like agents in their community because they have the model of young civil rights workers, and it's really important that they hear the stories of teenagers who were involved.
Did you say this was in the school? You did this through the schools, or?
The nonprofit is called Arts at Large, and they do arts across the curriculum programming in the public schools.
This is John Reynolds here from Paikane, and I want to focus, if we can. And this round, what do you think your impact was on changing the South politically? And I have Tyrone Brooks, who was with LCLC and is currently a state senator.
I just retired after 35 years this year.
Wow.
35 years was enough.
That's a lot.
Polonian, I saw, won't we start?
In what state were you?
Georgia.
Georgia.
So how did SCOPE help you get elected?
Well, of course, I was very close to Jose Williams all my career until he died in November 2000. I grew up here in Georgia, and I was one of those young teenagers who just attracted to Jose because of his magnetism and that magic, and I couldn't let him go. Dorothy Cotton was scheduled to be my supervisor in the citizenship education program, but I just couldn't stay away from Jose, so I ended up being on Jose's staff. I was hired in 1967, but I was active as a high school student and all the way through college. And I'm looking at this photograph here of some of my colleagues, Ben Clark, Benjamin Carr from Savannah, Stoney Cooks, Carl Ferris, Andrew Marcet, Golden Freaks, and Jose. Just looking at these pictures bring back memories. And down here, Roland Betts. So it brings back a lot of memories. But I was just doing an interview with Derek Gilliard in the Jose room of the hall, and I said to him that I thought the SCOPE project and all of that work that SCOPE did and the spinoffs from SCOPE in so many ways didn't get the kind of credit because it laid the foundation for the political revolution, the Voting Rights Act, the education of African Americans, with the support of many whites from the North, of course, the sacrifices that were made, that laid the foundation for the election of so many African-American elected officials from late 60s all the way through the 70s, but we had a huge number to come in the 70s, huge numbers, and then the 80s and 90s and on. SCOPE laid the foundation for this political revolution, and I think Bernard Lafayette will talk about that a little bit more, but I think what we sometimes don't appreciate is the fact that when we're involved in a movement, we don't pay much attention to the effect of it. And then we get older and we start reminiscing, we start looking back and we say, you know what? We changed America. We impacted the world. We made it possible for a Barack Obama to be president and for 46 African Americans to serve in Congress. And I thought that SCLC's SCOPE project, and I wish we had a SCOPE now. We need a SCOPE now to deal with the aftermath of losing the Voting Rights Act, Section 4, from the Supreme Court of June of 2013. Mm-hmm. But SCOPE was a revolutionary movement That's what it was. And we didn't see it that way, because SNCC was doing its thing before SCLC. But SCLC, particularly under the leadership of Jose Williams, was really revolutionizing the South. And having the mixture of white students coming down from the northern states and mixing in with African Americans down here in the deep South where we live, you know, think about Michael Schwerner, James Cheney, Andrew Goodman over in Philadelphia. You know, if Jose Williams had assigned me to Mississippi in 64 rather than South Georgia, North Florida in 64, I might have been in Mississippi. It might have been in Philadelphia. I think about that a lot. But there's no doubt in my mind that when you look at all of these, and I don't know if we are worthy of the work as a former elected official. I don't know if we are worthy of the work that was laid through the SCOPE and all of the other organizations and the foundation to put us in offices. Because sometimes when I'm speaking to black elected officials, I say we have let our people down. We have not done what they expected of us. We have not remained true to the movement that made it possible for us to serve. So many have gotten in the office. And I don't want to try to push myself out there and say that I'm anything great. But when I went into politics, it was because of Jose Williams, Dr. Rav Abernathy, Reverend Joe Boone, who was over Operation Breadbasket here in Atlanta before Jesse Jackson in Chicago. I went in because they pushed me in. I didn't think anybody would vote for me because I had the image of being a radical. I used to wear the big, big Afro, dashiki, Tommy Smith, John Carlos. I didn't think anybody would vote for me, but they did. So when I went in to the House of Representatives, I went in with the idea of taking the movement in there and doing the movement from within. And so I did my best for 35 years, but many of them came in, and they came in with the idea that they were supposed to just be there for themselves and be another politician. And I would say to them sometime in conversation, I would say, I think you're missing the point. It's not about you. It's about the people that sacrificed for you, that went to jail, that marched, dogs bit them, they inhaled tear gas, some died, and you don't understand the shoulders you're standing on. But to sum it up, I have to say that this man right here, the legendary Jose Williams, who was my second daddy in so many ways, he was Dr. King's field general. And he had the ability to ignite communities, to make them wake up and shake them up in a way in which nobody else on Dr. King's staff could do it. And I'm so glad that I was with him when he, up until he died, his daughter, Barbara Jean, will tell you, I was with him all the way up until his death in November of 2000.
The thing is, I think we don't realize how much what we did changed the South. And we gave dignity to folks who never had dignity before. When we went on those plantations back then, people were scared. But you was able to convince them to leave the plantation and go to the courthouse. And one of the things I think we treated black folks as equal during SCOPE. And I think that had a huge impact on their lives. I mean, you guys must remember how afraid people was to go to the courthouse. Mm-hmm. Before SCOPE, a lot of people had never been to the courthouse in their lives unless they would go on the court. You know, been arrested for something. So we did an amazing thing. Following up a little bit on what I was saying is that one of the things we was talking about at lunch today, that Dr. King would say to folks, I will send Anna Young to talk to you. But if you make me mad, or whatever, Jose is coming.
Okay.
And that was his sort of role. And the thing is that Jose became what Dr. Abernathy was to Dr. King. Dr. King never went to jail by himself. After Dr. King was assassinated, Jose went to jail every time Dr. King did. I mean, Dr. Abernathy did. So,
You're right. One story Andrew Young tells, I just want to jump in here and just say this and I'll be quiet.
Say your name again, please.
Tyrone Brooks, SCLC veteran. Andy says, and I wish Andy could be here today and let him say it for himself, but Andy would tell the story. We're neighbors over in southwest Atlanta. He says, a lot of times, Jose would just wreck a town, fill up the jails, and there would be an impasse as to what to do. And Dr. King would send Andy in to negotiate a settlement or mediate. And Andy would come in, you know, with his three-piece suit on and his little trim haircut and briefcase, looking like a nice middle-class Negro from New Orleans. And Andy would say, if he ever got into a situation where he couldn't resolve it, he would get his briefcase, pack his little belongings up, and get up and say, well, ladies and gentlemen, I have failed. I'm going to go back and report to Dr. King that I was not successful. I'm sorry. I'm just have to go back to Atlanta and tell him that I have flown. And I'm sure he'll send Jose back tomorrow. And Andy would say to you, if he was here, all of a sudden, the people would have a whole change of attitude. Like, Reverend Young, don't go. Let's just talk this thing out a little bit more. Let's just talk a little bit more. They did not want Jose Williams back because he was the man that could just take a town and turn it upside down. I don't know. He had magic.
Question. Ronjia Crawford here. I grew up in Chicago, and I got caught up with the busing. And see, I was just a little bit behind you guys. And what I got bused to an all-white school, and it was only six of us that got bused. And when we got there, Martin Luther King Day was trying to come alive. And so the school had Polish Day, Spanish Day, and they skipped us, Black Day. And so we protested in the school, all six of us. And so they gave us a little day. And then we looked into our U.S. history books. Where are we? And so we started complaining. This was around the time that Operation Breadbasket was up and hot, and the black masses were going on. So my little white school was going to go, was invited by Jesse Jackson to go to a black mass, and they saw what it was all about. So shortly after that happened, my question has to be do with this. Our history books went in the streets. They threw them out. And all of the history books got recalled. The problem with that is that when they came back, it still didn't tell the whole thing. It left you guys out.
Yeah.
Is that true today?
Yes.
Yes.
What are we doing? Is there anything?
You know, one of the things, the president made a point in Selma. If you don't vote, you lose your power.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing is that even though we done did all of what we did in 50 years ago, that was a point when everything was going, but now it done went down.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at the last few elections, we had less than double digit percentage of turnout. So the question now, you know, and the reason that these things happen is because we giving up our power. We giving up what we done worked for, what we done died for, what we went to jail for. We giving it up. And then, you know, what we got to do is educate politicians.
Mm. Before we get elected.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. That's what I'm going to tell you. I ran a campaign here in DeKalb County. They were running for state representative. Before I could commit to working on that campaign, she had to walk across the bridge in Selma. You know, we got to vote for people that have commitment to whatever the cause is. You know, we got to do that. Because what happened, you mentioned it, that politician is the cause of low turnout. Mm. We went out. We got the right to vote. We went out and got all emotion and voted. And then people put in office that then we didn't get nothing that we could identify with. We don't even get the debate or the issues. So the question of the day, how do we go back to our communities? How do we go back into our community and create the excitement for voting again? How do we do that? Now, one of the things that we fell a little short is in the 60s, we didn't politically educate enough. Today, we got to politically educate. We got to start in our community from our whatever ward, precinct. We got to teach people the importance of voting. We got to get people involved in local issues. You know, I tell my class that your local election is more important than the national election. You know, so you got to, you know, we got to politically educate. It's just I have a form that I can teach these students, but we got to spread it out much, much further. Because what's going to happen? What we don't work for and gave our life for, that we're not going to be able, we're going to lose it. All right, that's why they're challenging the voting bill. We're not doing what we're supposed to do.
91.
We're not doing what we're supposed to do. People don't care no more. See, you know, the whole voting thing was an emotional thing. But once your emotion get the air out, you know, we got thousands and thousands of black elected officials all over the country. And we still had these concerns. We got the Black Caucus in Washington, D.C.
So I'd like to pick up on what Richard said. This is Al Compound from, was in Lunenburg County in 65.
What county?
Lunenburg, Virginia.
Virginia, okay.
And also relating to what John said earlier, there was an important, very important role that the movement played, SCLC in particular, in confrontational issues or situations, Selma and Birmingham and things like that. That was a very important part of the struggle, but there was another component which I think was embodied by most of us who were in SCOPE were not involved in confrontational issues, but we were doing the door-to-door sorts of things. And I know that a white boy in Lunenburg or white girls in Lunenburg could knock on doors and talk to people who never really thought about getting registered. We knew it was going to be difficult, and we helped to open up the registration process somewhat in the county while we were there to double the amount of hours that the registrar was available. But to be able to knock on people's doors and to at least plant a seed, to know that somebody came from outside the county and said, look, we understand the importance of the voting and the registration process and so on, get people interested in learning about the process and eventually getting people registered. The grassroots movement from below was just as important as those confrontational issues, the Selmas and Birminghams and so on. I think that was an important legacy of SCOPE from having lots of young people mostly from the north to engage with those communities and to be able to worship in those rural churches on Sundays or on the Wednesday prayer times and so on, to engage with them. That was an important piece that hopefully was lasting.
John Reynolds here again. Respond to your question about our story and what we do. I hope that this is the beginning by documenting what we're discussing here today and preserving our history. I hope other folks would write books about their experiences so that those, you know, get into school and stuff like that, and so that young people will know about those kids in Birmingham. They will know about the West kids in Selma. So if we begin to tell our story, hopefully, you know, it will have some impact. But we also need to tell our own kids and grandkids our story. I think we've been reluctant to tell our own kids our story. So they don't know what you did, most of them.
I think, Barb Foster, I had the feeling when I went back from Georgia to Indiana, and then eventually my husband and I worked, he's a pastor, and we worked in several areas, and I felt nobody really cared what I did, and that was very hard, because when I was with a group like this, everybody celebrated the whatever we accomplished, and I've had that experience many times. I lived in a very diverse area for 18 years, and it was wonderful because I was able to make impressions or help impact some of the kids. And I'm now back in Indiana where I started, and it's just an incredibly closed area. And every day I try and make, and I felt that way when I was in Georgia, every day whomever I impacted, I had to change something in terms of the way they thought or acted so that things were better. And I think the interactions I had with some of the people were not necessarily just for scope, but it was just for, like someone had said, we made them feel important. And that person was important to me right now. And I remember sitting with elderly women. They wanted to learn how to read and write because they wanted to read their Bible and because they wanted to write their children's names for the first time. That was an incredible experience. And sadly, I didn't stay in touch with all of the people, so I don't know whether they actually followed up and voted or if their children learned, you know, things. And so my feeling is I'm very, I don't want to say very, but I'm discouraged because I'm not sure how to connect with a larger movement, people, something, because it feels as though everything I'm doing is very singular. And I'm not connected, other than the church. I ran for Congress. I'm not talking about not doing anything, but it's just that endless feeling that I'm out here swimming on my own sometimes.
My name is Richard Smiley. One of the things that I always share with people, you had to operate within your space. Okay, sometimes we look for, we want to have a big movement. But the movement is right there with you. The movement is the one that you can reach out and touch. And if you plant the right seeds, the harvest will grow, it'll manifest itself. So it just happened, like I operate in the classroom. All right, hopefully that I plant some seeds in the classroom will manifest in the community. I don't look for a big movement. I just look to do what I do where I am very well. And because it can be very frustrating. It can be very frustrating when you're trying to look to be with a group or lead a group or meet with a lot. Just operate where you at.
Rondia Coffer here again. I agree with what Smiley just said, and being just that little behind you guys when you and being on that bus and being bussed. I was being bussed from the ghetto, who was mostly Malcolm X's thinking. And at this time, Malcolm X was thinking, you can't trust anybody but your people of your own color. And there was a lot of black racism going on there. And when I got bussed to the white school, they were throwing rocks at me too. Because they thought that, you know, I had crossed over and everything.
This in Chicago?
This is in Chicago.
It wasn't Skokie, Gage Park, or Cicero, was it?
Well, they were close by. Down there on Cicero. But what happened in the long run is, yes, Sister went to an all-white school, and it was only six of us from the neighborhood that did go. And we brought that education back. We were the first ones to even mention college. Because if you mention college to any of our friends, they're like, that's not for me. We can't afford to do that. We're not going to. And you know they didn't. They didn't. But then the word got out. Their children did. You know, so I think that that's where it's going to come. And we had to overcome black racism. And that's why you got what you got.
Well, Arkansas here, kind of the bridge between then and now, after my time in mostly Alabama and being on the front lines, and then I was at the Black Power SNCC convention in Kingston Springs, and everything started really fracturing and falling apart, and it's like, there ain't no place where, you know. So then I got in the anti-war movement, and then I moved to Chicago eventually and was a rank and file labor organizer for many years. I did 25 years of hard labor loading trucks. And finally I got into school in the 90s and got my degrees after I was 50 years old. Got a Master of Humanities in Philosophy and History and Political Science, and then I couldn't get a job. They didn't want anyone who knew what they were talking about to actually infest kids. And so I substitute taught for 13 years, but I never could get a real job. And how do you get the history to the current generation if they're not allowed to know any history? And what there is just like we got it 60 years ago. It's like just a few names, dates, and facts. And they don't relate. You got to give stories. You got to give people. And like and I'll close with this, but like Birmingham, Selma, and almost every town, Greenwood, Albany, it was mostly kids between 12 and 17 years old who were the first ones out there taking on the monsters. And then when the kids got beaten up, the parents would come. And in Selma, it was so interesting. The children got driven out to Camp Selma. And then the teachers actually came out. It's like, wow, this is really something. But people don't know this. They don't know where it came from and how it got built. And I'll just close with one thing. A turning point in the whole movement was the night after Bloody Sunday in Selma. And you can read about it in Cheyenne Webb's book. She was 8 years old. She was on the bridge. Read it in her book, Selma, Lord, Selma. I was sitting right behind her in the pews that night in Brown's Chapel, church full of tear gas and people moaning and moaning and moaning. And she said, it was such a downer, and everybody was crying and moaning. It's like we've really been put in our place by a good whooping. And then the moaning started turning, and somehow it turned into humming, and then it was a freedom song. And at first we didn't know what it was, and ain't gonna let no tear gas turn me round, turn me round, turn me round. Ain't gonna let no tear gas turn me round. Ain't gonna keep on a walking.
Right.
And then she said, and then the whole church picked up on it, and everybody was singing. It was like we hadn't been beat. We had won. And at that moment, I think that was the turning point of the whole movement. Because up until then, they might have killed us all and got away with it. And right at that moment, the spirit came back, and we knew we were going to win. We didn't win everything, but we won a major battle. Mm-hmm. And that kind of history needs to come. People, children, they need to learn that. How can they learn it unless we're doing it?
Have you written your book?
No, I keep trying, but my life has been so severe.
You've got to do what John has done. I was reading John, but John has done what all of us should do. Dr. Lafayette has done it. Hosea didn't complete his book, so now he and his children and I, and I consider myself Hosea's
son. You talked about
that
book alone.
Yeah, we gotta finish it. Baba Jean, Elizabeth, all of us gotta finish the book. But
yeah,
John has hit on something that is very important. That is, we gotta document our lives, our stories, our histories, put it in books, because we're not gonna be around much longer.
Yeah.
Okay, now Dr. King left us at 39.
Yep.
So we are blessed to be here. Just looking around, and, you know, we're blessed to be here. We far past 39, but I think that's the key, because here is the future, whether we like it or not. Mm-hmm. This is the Black Lives Matter movement. It is a movement And what impresses me about this movement, in many communities, I see majority groups who are white leading it. Majority white students and young people leading the Black Lives Matter movement. So it's not a racial movement, but they say, oh, Black Lives does matter, and we want to be a part of it. It was just like Scope. It was just like all of the other projects we saw in the 60s with young students like you sitting there at Brown Chapel behind Cheyenne Webb.
Yeah.
So I think it's important for us. Now, Rita Samuels, who's out there in the hall, who worked for Dr. King before I got to SCLC, she's here. She needs to come in here and sit with you all because she not only worked for Dr. King, she worked for Governor Jimmy Carter, President Jimmy Carter, and she keeps telling me I need to write my books. And I said, Rita, you need to write your books. I think it's so important for us to do that because we've got to connect our life experiences with the present day movement, today's movement, right now.
Barbara
so
Oscar,
I think that's very important.
Do all of you know about the Southern Poverty Law Center?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
They send this material to all the schools. And I want to check because I'm just recently moved to our area.
Where are you living?
Batesville, Indiana.
Okay.
It's about 50 miles west of Cincinnati.
West of who?
Cincinnati.
Oh.
But I just think these kind of things, they have people who are talented, do research, and are able. And if I can't do it, I feel if I can support them financially, hopefully this will help too, because there's a lot of things that I think if teachers are using this in their curriculums, any of the articles, it's a step forward. So this is a good
I think,
resource.
John Reynolds here again. I think anything that we can do, Bruce Hartford had the Civil Rights Veterans website. If you can't write a book, send your stuff to him and let him digitize it and keep it safe that way because a lot of students use that site. So they get a lot of traffic. And by using that site, if you're interested in telling your story, you just write up a thing and say that you are available to speak and even in your local community. So you probably get some phone calls from students who invite you.
We need to know the website again.
CRM.
CRM.
Is it in the book already?
Yeah.
Oh, it's in the book.
It's in the book.
Yeah, yeah, it's there.
I just haven't had a chance to peruse the book. Okay, I got it.
Okay. And he's here too.
Yes.
Kathy Schwartz, Lunenburg County. Just to follow up a little bit on what Al was saying about being in Lunenburg County. I felt like, you know, we didn't stay in one place for the whole time. I was there for two different summers, 65 and 66, and we moved every two or three weeks and stayed with different people. And what impressed me about that was we got to meet the teenagers and the families and talk to them about what was going on and invited them to come to Birmingham when there was, in the middle of the summer, there was that movement. And they were, it was so exciting to see them get excited about what we were doing and talking with their own parents about what was going on. And that the second summer was Virginia was starting to integrate the schools. And we did a, quote, freedom school kind of thing, basically with the idea of, well, people, these kids, it was the first grade and the 12th grade, which was like totally crazy. You know, we canvass all over the place, like nobody's going to come, everybody's working in tobacco. But people came and had an opportunity to deal with white people in that kind of situation and work on their writing. And they were writing about Vietnam, 65, their cousins, their brothers, who were there, which was a real eye-opener to us from the North, and we had lots of discussions with them about that. And it's the last thing I want to say is Mr. Hawthorne, Nathaniel Lee Hawthorne, he had said to me, Kathy, can't stay or go. but you can't keep coming back and forth. If you want to stay here and work with us, that's fine. If you don't, go home to Boston, and because there's lots of work for you to be done up there. And so I decided to go home, but it was coming, it was that experience in the South for me that enabled me to go back to Boston and look at what the issues were, what was going on. There was busing. There was, and before that, there was Mel King and Louise Day Hicks and all of that. And so anyway, I think that we from the North learned a lot for ourselves about, like, our white skin privilege, what we should be doing at home. So it was such
a two-way street there. Yeah.
Two-way street.
Yeah. Charlie Buell's Surrey County. I just want to underline that, the Southern Poverty Law Center. Their stuff is so good that they are getting death threats every day.
Oh, yeah.
And have you ever seen pictures of their office in Montgomery? It looks like a World War II pillbox, and is necessary, you know, for that. And they're really laying things out, doing something like this, you know, for the school level. But they're following the hate groups, and really doing really good work there. I just wanted just one other thing here. I got a letter. I was in written correspondence with some of the people I was working with in Surrey, and there was an election there. And this is the results of the election. It says the registration books closed, and on October 2nd, there was 1,100 Negroes registered in Surrey County. This was due to your efforts. Well, they'd done a lot of work before, but no, thank you. I'm sorry to inform you that only about a half of them voted on November 2nd. And it's the old thing, whether it is rural South, whether it is in in an urban area, it get out the vote, have the local captains working there. It's the nuts and bolts of politics. And actually, this National Association of the Southern Poor. You ever hear about Don Anderson? Mm-hmm. He set up different countywide organizations, and the key man who was there set up the first one in Surrey County, and he really concentrated on getting block captains, street captains, not blocks. There weren't any paved sidewalks there, but breaking it down like that so that people would get people registered, and then on election day, get them out to vote. And it's absolutely key, and it builds the community in itself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I just told John I have to leave to go to the University of Georgia and Athens to do a seminar, but I'll be back tomorrow. But I worked with Mel King on the divestment of South Africa, Governor Michael Dukakis and all of us.
Yes. Mel King has such a long career.
We were in classes at the John F. Kennedy School of Government in Cambridge on how to do it. But one thing I want to leave with you, John, Dr. Joseph Lowry, he said, he's 94, he's our neighbor over in Southwest, and he said, son, everything has changed, but nothing has changed. Yeah. That's from a 90-year-old veteran, 94. October 6th, he's 94, which is coming up. But just remember that as you continue to think. Everything has changed, but nothing has changed.
Thank you, Tara.
Arkansas here, picking up on what you said, Charlie, there are so many strategical moves, and to build a movement, you don't have to necessarily do all of them, but you got to do a lot of them. And one thing, when Bernard went into Selma in 1962 and started laying the groundwork and connecting with people in G's Bend and Camden and stuff, one thing they did, along with educating, was they built block organizations and ward organizations right in Selma. Now then SCLC came in and they had the mass movement concept, and the movement could not have won what it did without both.
Yeah, right.
But then it sort of became a war, my tactics against your tactics, and things got really hostile and falling apart. But there were people like Bernard and like me and like Richard and others who tried to work with both groups. And sometimes one group would claim we were a spy for the other group. And no, we're a bridge. Mm-hmm. You know, and in a war, what do? The first thing, you blow up the bridges. So we mm-hmm. suffered a whole lot of damage in that, but you mm-hmm. had to have both. Martin couldn't have come in to Selma and built the movement there if the movement hadn't have already started. Yeah. And that was Bernard and Wirth Long and Maria Varela and people like that who got it going.
Wanting.
Yeah, and that's how, I mean, you gotta, you don't have to do everything, but you gotta do more than one thing.
I invited the daughter of one of the Courageous Eight and Seven, that was called the Courageous Eight. It was Miss Boynton and Mr. Gillisleeve and Reverend Reese. It was a group that invited Dr. King in the cell during that time. But SNCC had been there, you know, from 1962. But one of the things I'd like to see that we leave here in thought, how are we going to do get out the vote? See, we can register all the peoples in the world. If we can't get them out to vote, it don't matter. So the question is, we have to get people excited by voting again. And I don't know the particular answer right now, but you know, it's something that needs to be planned. How do we get people out of, you know, because people have been hurt. You know, they've been hurt. And now we got to motivate them to get back out to the poll.
You know, candidates.
And what happened is, and I'm going to throw something up here, I'm going to probably create some. See, politicians will create a race thing out of voting.
Yeah.
Okay, you know, you got the Democrats and the Republican race, you got the Republicans and the Democrats is crazy. You got all this. So what happened as voters, we just said, we ain't going to vote for either one of them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, so we got to come to the point that we got to start, you know, political education. We got to teach people what the, you know, what the issues is in their community, in their state, you know, how it affect them. See, sometimes if you don't know how something affect you, you just throw up your hands. But we got to go back to our communities. We got to, if we're going to hook up with something, hook up on one of the elections, let's do something to get out the vote. Let's do something to get people excited. Let me say one more thing. What I tried to do, and I talked to the Board of Election in Hillsborough County about bring early voting to college. And you know, because that's where all the college students are. It's in the environment. But the answer they gave me, which I'm going to work on when I get back, it's a state law that you can't do early voting on college campus.
Wow. I wonder who was behind that.
Yeah. I don't know who was behind it, but it's something that, you know, I think if we can get young folks voting, you know, we can get them right there on the college campus, wherever college they in, I think that would increase, because young people don't vote.
One quick question, and I have to, Dave, you guys can go on. Following up on that, I have extended the website for another year. So one of the questions is, do we want to stay connected going forward and keep SCOPE alive?
Reunion website, just
right.
To be clear.
Yeah, the reunion website. So we're going to extend that for another year or so, and we can go longer. It's up to us. You know, but think about what we want to do that or not.
Margaret Roska, I've been wanting to say something for about four people
okay,
now.
Okay, go ahead.
Margaret Roska from Bullock County, Alabama. I think extending the website is a good idea, especially to share strategies for voter registration and to encourage writers, if one of the goals is to have people write their stories. The question I have, and maybe John has an answer to this, is at one point I was doing research at the Martin Luther King Center, the one that Coretta started, and there are tapes of all of the orientation sessions from the SCOPE orientation, and there are all the papers from the planning meetings and from There's letters that were written back and forth during the summer. For example, when there was a kind of a crisis in Hale County, Hosea's letters to the local leaders in Hale. There's all kinds of documents. I don't know where they are now. Is that part of what Emory University bought from the King children? But if you want to write your own story, there are those primary documents by which you can check your memory and refresh your memory. And so one of the things that the website could do is locate those documents for us.
Andy Young's, and I'm sorry, Kathy Schwartz, I just quickly say, Andy Young's speech was so powerful, his speech about nonviolence. He taught us about nonviolence, and he said, if you do not buy into nonviolence, if you cannot do this, then you cannot come.
But getting the sources is important here, and I think
it's fascinating to listen to that.
I think Bruce Hartford would have some ideas as to where to go. But yeah, his booklet of all those things. Go ahead.
If you look on that website, they got Google's information on that veteran website. They got original notes and reports, and they do have some information about the orientation. Talk to Joe Freeman.
But there's nothing like hearing Hosea's voice in the morning start to sing. It's the if those tapes could be digitized and made available, or if they can't be, then we need to know where they're located.
Right. Yeah, talk to Joe Freeman and Barbara, Jose's daughter. Talk to them and see can they locate that information. I'm sure Barbara should have some of those some of those tapes. We had tapes then.
Well, if they were already the property of the Martin Luther King Center. Unless she has duplicate.
I don't know whether they was a part of the center.
Well, that's where they were. That's where I listened to them.
Oh, okay. Oh. All right. So you might be a problem. Because they've been hard to get stuff out of the center.
Wow.
Yeah.
Like the movie.
Yeah, like the, even the Selma movement, it was hard to get the right to use certain speeches.
Yeah.
And, so that's a challenge.
Can I make one point? This is Al Kampan. I just wanted to circle back to the question about moving forward and getting people out to vote and so on. I think one of the first things that we need to do is to reestablish a form of the Voting Rights Act. So the Title IV, whatever title it was, that was specifically targeted southern states because of the history of voter restrictions. We now need that to cover the entire country.
Yeah.
Speaking as an Ohio resident, and also watching what goes on across the border in Michigan. But all the states now systematically are trying to jerry-rig the voting process. So whether it's gerrymandering, outrageous examples of gerrymandering, we've never had such as this before in my state, but also restricting the voting, whether it's college campus voting and that sort of thing. These are unlawful, in my opinion, unconstitutional restrictions on people's voting, which is it's a much more subtle form of racism and economic racism and so on that need to be addressed, and we will not be able to address it as long as state legislatures and others can do this kind of have this kind of impact on restricting the voting.
Arkansas here, quick point. Some states are beginning to set up nonpartisan redistricting bodies. That is an important thing to push if there's any possibility of your state doing that.
Tom Rothschild, I was in Newberry County. I haven't spoken because I'm not somebody who recorded a lot when I was there, and I haven't been back to Newberry. Until this week, I'm going to be there again, so it's been hard for me to really speak about, you know, what was the outcome. But I think that the last comments are very important in terms of looking where we go forward. So we saw the immediate impact of the Voting Rights Act, which those of us who were there helped to enhance. and move forward. And I think it's probably in some ways a good idea to let go of the idea that it's got to target certain historic areas, and that we now have movements to duplicate those historic vote suppression efforts countrywide, and so we need some kind of countrywide way to attack that. I don't know what that is yet. It certainly at this point is not through the courts, and it certainly at this point is not through the Congress. So we have to really need to look for ways to create openings. And frankly, in some states that have quote-unquote nonpartisan redistricting commissions, they're just a smokescreen for the partisan work that happens anyway. So it's not in itself a panacea or a cure. It's not to say it's a wrong direction, but there has to be something to enforce its being nonpartisan. And I do want to say, in terms of impact, where I worked next was in Mississippi. And in Mississippi in 1967, I was part of the Freedom Democratic Party, which then elected the first state senator, African-American state senator, since Reconstruction. In the county that I worked as part of that campaign. They had a whole slate for every county office, but again, looking at the question of fear and reluctance and, you know, whatever, he was the only one elected. But he stayed in office until 2004. He has a state building named after him. He actually gained respect in the state house, was a pro tem speaker, did a lot of things after, you know, things began to shift. So that tells me that, in fact, maybe some of the things we did had some part of impact that we couldn't even see. And it certainly says that we have to look at ways to move forward. And I'm not saying I know what they are. I think we've heard some good ideas today. But I think that's a real reason to try to keep this going. So here we are after 50 years. I haven't had any contact for 50 years. But I'm still doing things where I am. And I think if we can kind of put our collective selves together and make use of this website and in conjunction with the Civil Rights Vets website and other resources, that we can begin to look for the solutions. And also, I think, Rhonda, as you said, how do we get the children, but the rising generations to understand the importance of this? It's very popular these days, certainly in the area where I am, for politically correct people, let's just leave it at that, to say, well, nothing has changed in 400 years. And I think it's important to recognize that makes emotional sense but not historical sense. And that's not to say that the change in 400 years is either anywhere near sufficient or all in a straight line moving forward. Some of that change is moving backward, but if you don't recognize the change, you can't support what moves forward, and you can't work against what moves backward, because you say, well, nothing has changed, so unless we have a complete revolution, nothing can change. And I don't think that makes sense either. And speaking of our friends over there who are talking about nonviolence, my conclusion about revolutions is, no matter what, there's a tremendous amount of violence that always raises the question of whether the revolution was worth it, whether it was here, for whatever we may think of this revolution, or in Russia, or in France, you know, where Can we now, having had all those experiences, find some other way to bring about broad change that doesn't involve killing thousands upon thousands upon thousands of people, one way or another? So I'll kind of end it with that.
Well, just to quote on that briefly, Arkansas here, Martin, he didn't use these words, but he always referred to the concept that the process always influences the product. And so if you go into violence in the process, you will have violence in the product. And that's a crucial thing.
Amen.
Okay.